This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin with me. I was going to say Tan Chung Han, but of course it's not.
Different Chinaman.
Yeah, the old switcheroo on me, Kusu Chuang there.
Because I call Han voice. Sharad. See, that's the problem.
Yeah.
And he's a, you know.
Have you called Han?
I call Han Sharad.
Yeah, I know. We have the same kind of girth. And we'll come back to that later on. Just quick note.
Kind of girth.
Yes. Some things that happened overnight. Some numbers, actually. So we have floods in South Asia. That would be India, Nepal, and Bangladesh. Quite devastating for those countries. It's left some 250 people dead. And so that's a toll over a couple of days now. Also, a campaign to plant trees to compensate for the impact of Donald Trump's climate policies has had over 120,000 pledges.
And so what's the point of a pledge? So just to show support, is it?
No, you pledge to actually plant a tree. You plant a tree either in your own area or you can plant it in a country. You can pay for the planting of a tree. The idea is to offset Donald Trump's withdrawal from, you know, policies that, you know, would retard the climate change.
I think retard is the right word.
Well, this is a president who is getting no love, isn't it?
Does he not deserve it?
Yeah, he deserves no love. I think it's the most global phenomenon now.
Reminds me of that millionaire, Dennis Publishing, Felix Dennis. He made so much money from his business. And at some point in time, he had an inflection point. He had a Eureka, Tom Cruise, Jerry Maguire movement. And he started buying huge pieces of land in the UK. And he planted huge swaths of forest to replace the, you know, the cover.
Oh, really? You know, what's also interesting about Barack Obama when he was president was that, you know, he created national parks. And it was a kind of a tradition for some of America's presidents. And he creates, I think, some of the largest national parks that the U.S. has.
Who, Barack Obama?
Barack Obama. And what's interesting about Donald Trump is that when he came in, he wanted to undo that as well. You know,
what an idiot.
Yeah. Well, I don't think so. He is, and I think represents a particular kind of mindset, right? It's there on the spectrum. It's just that it hasn't achieved this kind of power in a long time. And so you see this in his attitudes towards climate change, his attitudes to healthcare, his attitudes towards what's happened in Charlottesville and racism and such.
Yeah,
and, you know,
yeah.
And, you know, because we had news also that he's disbanded two business councils.
That's right.
Because he was anticipating more defections from it. So as CEOs dropped out or resigned, and in fact, there was news that or talk that they would issue a statement, a joint statement against him, that he moved in a preemptory fashion.
Yeah.
Okay. So also numbers: 32 killed in a single night in the Philippines. Very bloody war on drugs that just happened over Tuesday night.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot, and that happened just Tuesday night. And they're just counting the cost of that policy by Rodrigo Duterte. Also, China is to stop importing coal, iron ore, and seafood from North Korea. China holds apparently 90% of North Korea's international trade. So this is going to be big.
Yeah. This is really one of the strategies postulated by the analysts in terms of North Korea's military ambitions. It's one thing to stand pat and issue statements and warnings. It's another to just say, hey, look, we're going to stop doing business with you, and you're already thin economy. We'll just get more crippled. And the biggest partner for North Korea is China.
Yeah.
So you just got to get the Chinese support to come and do this. And it looks as if it's starting to happen.
It is. And let's see how this pays off. But first, we have the Beatles and Get Back, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Kusu Chuang and myself, Sharad Kutin, and we're taking you all the way into the start of the morning run. So we're poised at our starting blocks. It's because coming up to 8 minutes past six, and it is the 17th of August, 2 days before the start of the SEA Games. And
exactly. Yeah. Are you waiting with bated breath?
Yes, I am. Well, not for the opening ceremonies. I'm not a big fan of opening and closing ceremonies, but I am.
Let the games begin.
I would like to go, and I've looked at the lineup online to buy tickets. I haven't bought any tickets yet, but I'm trying to work it out in terms of my schedule. I think it'd be interesting to watch. And you mentioned the fact that some of the events that you would go to
sold
have
out.
Been sold out, right?
right? Swimming, silat, basketball.
I mean, what the games are about are young bodies, athletic, primed, and it's such a beautiful, it's an aesthetic event. I think the Greeks knew this and the Romans, and, you know, there was no shame about it. They really, sports and beauty were really intertwined.
Hence the loincloths and the togas.
Especially in the
the gusti, obviously, you know.
What, gusti?
Wrestling.
No? Oh, wrestling. Oh, ah. Wrestling gusti. Okay. Now, we just had news. This might upset you, but actor Tom Cruise has broken his ankle in two places doing a stunt on the set of Mission Impossible 6. Or was it 7?
Yeah, things sprung out. I mean, number one, there's 6 installments of Mission Impossible.
And apparently.
Two, why is Tom Cruise at the ripe old age of 100 or whatever?
No, 55. He's actually 55, yeah.
You know, 55 in the old, you know, back in the day, was sedentary geriatricism, wasn't it?
No, that's true. But you know, the
it was.
No, I think
55.
Well, because he's retirement age for
yeah.
From a,
but look at him; he's jumping here, jumping there.
Yeah. So this is interesting. I want to kind of put that together with news that Daniel Craig is coming back as Bond, James Bond, in the James Bond series, of which there are more than I mean, if you complain about the number of Mission Impossible movies, think about the James Bond series, because I think it's superior. But still, Daniel Craig, and both of them represent on-set and off-set, off-screen and on-set, very different visions of masculinity, right? Daniel Craig, by the way, is 49 years old. He's slightly older than Yu Chuang.
No spring chicken, that's for sure.
And slightly younger than me, right? But you think about the kind of Bond he plays, not just athletic, but because that you could achieve through, technology as well as stuntmen and all that. But also sexuality, right? So he's extraordinarily sexualized Bond in
Daniel Craig. You know, that's what people say about him, but I can't see even one iota of... Well, you know, maybe because I'm straight.
Yeah, and it's so the idea is not that it appeals to you, right? But it, the Sean
to women, as, yeah.
The Sean Connerys and
to me, Sean Connery was the man, Sherrod. You know,
yeah. But you see, also, so he was sexy in a way that he was suave and gentlemanly. Yeah, he had that physicality, right? But what's now happened is that we have these scenes where Bond is walking out of the water in his swimming trunks, right? Which is something that the Bond series would have only reserved just for women.
Does that send you into a tizzy, Sherrod?
No, I think what it's important, what it does intellectually is to let me think about the question of an evolving nature of the bond and the idea of what it is to be a man. And I think that's very interesting. Popular culture is reflecting those changes. So both men and women are equally sexualized, and that's a very modern part of their demeanor. Well, the other thing about Tom Cruise is that the fact that he insists on doing his own stunts seems to be a very personal thing, because he doesn't have to do it, right?
No, he doesn't have to do it.
So why do you think he does it?
Because he thinks he can, I think, and by and large, he probably probably does it better than most other people.
And, you know, because I think acting in a Mission Impossible movie might be quite boring, because I don't know how many serious moments of dialogue.
Well, I saw the last one, MI5, the most outstanding scene is when they go through a bike chase, two of them.
Yeah, what I mean is
amazing.
That,
and he did it all by himself, by
right,
the way.
Right, so if he didn't do it all by himself, he would be in the trailer waiting for those scenes where he's speaking, right?
Yeah.
So it must be extraordinarily boring, because all the fun stuff gets done by the stuntmen and the body doubles, and it gets done through the magic of movies. So
CGI,
and all that, right? So I can see why he would be motivated to want to do this stuff.
What maketh a man? What maketh masculinity? I don't think we should be following popular culture and saying, oh, he's a man, I think we should model our lives after him.
Yeah, because clearly being fit is important. Being healthier. I don't know about being super slim and looking good in a bikini is great for men, but or a bikini bottom.
You know what makes a man is when the apocalypse hits and the zombies come out and the power grid goes off and you've got to go and find your own food and you've got to fend for your family. That's a man.
It's defending your cache of canned tomatoes and sardines. I think because I know.
Do you know how to make a fire?
Yeah.
Do you know how to build a fire?
Yeah, I can rub two stones like flint.
You know, I've got friends in the army.
Yeah, with matchbox. I have lots of matches. No?
Lighters you can buy.
Hey, lighters you can buy. But what you cannot buy is the music of the Black Keys. This is Gold on the Ceiling, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Kusu Chuang, and the morning run continues. It's coming up to 19 minutes past 6, and it is the 17th of August. How to be nice. I think it's a lesson. If there were lessons, I would buy Donald Trump a course on how to be nice. And how to be classy as a president. He seems to have no clue as to how to do this.
He has no idea about a lot of things. I don't know how he's a president of the United States. But I think you're referring to this article we're talking about how there's a difference between politeness and compassion. And of course, I don't understand why there's an article written about this. This is intuitive, isn't it? If you're nice, you're nice, but it's very different from being compassionate. You can't be compassionate and not being polite, right?
Yes, I guess, but we often associate the two. Though compassion, I suspect, is something that we see as being somewhat deeper and as a feeling and also as a commitment. Whereas politeness seems to be about some formalities, right? So often, how you deal with strangers, how you deal with people professionally, whether you shake their hands or don't shake their hands or why. These are conventions that are politeness. And so being polite, it's probably the easier thing to achieve. It's the low-hanging fruit in terms of your relationship with people because all you need to do is tick those boxes and be aware of your social circumstances and act accordingly, right? So being polite is just that. It's, polite society. It doesn't suggest that it's very deep. It just suggests that everybody conforms to a certain protocol, right? I mean, that's how I see politeness.
Humans are complex creatures, and I think there are so many layers to the human psyche. And dictated by so many factors that I don't think it's fair to categorize people accordingly and to have these scientific bases. I mean, for example, I'm just going to give some anecdotes, right? Back in the day in Penang, when there weren't that many cars on the road, there were a few times that I ran out of petrol because I was driving my Mini around. And invariably, Sharad, the people who came to my help and the ones who helped me, take me to the petrol station to get a canister of petrol were the poor people, the people on motorbikes, the people in cars. They didn't even bother with you. So to me, that's compassionate, right?
Right, yeah.
Right? And, a lot of Indian fellas would... I mean, because my car broke down a lot of times, right? Because my fuel gauge never used to work, so I never knew how much petrol there was left in the tank.
Oh, and I think the days where you were struggling as a young journalist.
Last night, no, sure. Like when I was a teenager,
So what were you saying about us Indian fellas?
Seriously. So there's four or five times I broke down, Mount Erskine, the windy road, not many cars. And out of those four or five times, all of them were guys on motorbikes, a couple of Malay fellas, and more than, the Indian fellas, the Chinese fellas never used to stop.
Well, I think there isn't a real race issue.
I don't know whether there's a trend here or...
I don't know. I wouldn't take this. I think on race, I would hesitate to draw any broad conclusions.
Really? No?
I think on class, though, I think there is an issue. I do notice...
Financial circumstances, because if you're driving a BMW... Why would you stop to let a scruffy kid into your car and take him to the gas station?
The idea is that
but this
the,
is like
the well-heeled are not so...
Your leather upholstery...
They're scared of being robbed or so. I mean, the people with things are often are scared about losing
and
their
equally, rich people who run charities in the name of doing good... I think there's a huge amount of disingenuity about it.
Well, yes,
they don't really care about the people. They just want to have these charity balls.
I wouldn't be so quick to judge other people and their motivations. But yesterday we were talking about this because the news came out that Bill Gates had given a couple of $1 billion to the foundation that he and his wife started. And we had a tweet that came in that told us about this not so well-known American billionaire who gave pretty much all his money, and he had this philosophy of giving while he was living. And a guy called Chuck Feeney, and who's, I think at this point in time, because I just read the article, we tweeted out yesterday, he's 85, he's down to about 2 million, he's given away billions. And his idea was to be really pretty much just adequate when he dies. He's given it,
you know,
and he's
given
it to a lot of foundations. Yeah,
I don't want to sound cynical again, but Sharad, you know how there's a saying that goes, no great fortune was built. Great fortune is always built on the back of certain crimes, right? So especially in Asia, where the billionaires and the millionaires have gotten to where they are because of certain machinations, certain deviations, right? So by giving away, and I'm not going to name, because there's a very famous Malaysian billionaire who has pledged half his fortune to charity, right? They're buying passports to heaven.
They're
trying to buy creds. Do you know what I mean?
Like karma.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, and maybe that's, you know, but it doesn't make it any less worthwhile or worthy, you know,
well,
when
no,
you do
because,
that, right?
Because the intentions are not noble. I mean, I just read this book called Burmese Days by George Orwell before the 1984. George Orwell, Burmese Days, right?
Yeah, because he was stationed there.
Correct,
for a while,
he was
right?
A policeman there. Hmm. And there was this, low life or mid-ranking government servant called Mipo Kin or something, I can't remember his name. And he spent the greater half of his life, you know, taking bribes and embezzling public funds. And then he planned for the last 2 or 3 years or his retirement age to build stupas and to build monasteries and to build temples. And ironically, he died before he even got there.
But you're
trying to buy creds in heaven.
So what? I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. And in fact, a lot of religious belief systems have
this. The intention
not
there, la.
Yeah, it doesn't matter because it is the action that you do and the consequence it has on the lives of others that is important, right? You might focus on it and say, it's like people who say, well, you're not a true vegetarian if you eat mock meat and you go to those restaurants where, you know, things look like meat, but in fact, soy protein. And I think, well, I don't know, actually, because the animals that didn't get slaughtered, probably very happy that you chose to eat mock meat, whether it looks like a chicken or not, right?
I don't mind the whole thing. Anyway,
okay,
yeah.
Maybe. Oh, we had a tweet in from Lee Jo Wen, who tells us there's, in fact, a Twitter thread that you can look at if you want to look at the discussion around manliness. It's called The Art of Manliness.
It's a website, actually.
It's a website, is it?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
okay,
yeah,
so
yeah.
Check that out. But now we have Aerosmith and Cryin, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that's Grace for Saints and Ramblers by Iron and Wine. Lots of ands in that, both in the title and in the name of the group.
What's the name of the band and what's the name of the song?
Iron and Wine.
Iron and Wine.
And the song is Grace for Saints and Ramblers.
Gosh darn. Sounds like an American band.
That's Kusu Chuang and I'm Sharad Kutin. It's just a little past 40 minutes after 6 on the 17th of August. Have you been following the Charlottesville events? I mean, it included a death, in fact, a murder, I think it would be called it, and all that, the fallout from that.
No, I followed the British Football League, actually, the Premiership. The season started, so.
Okay,
I
so regardless of whether you followed or not, just note yesterday, former American President Barack Obama's tweet. Made a Twitter history with attracting more likes than ever a tweet has in human history, the history of Twitter, more than 3.3 million likes.
Can I read it?
Mm-hmm.
He quoted Nelson Mandela in his tweet as saying, open quote, "No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion." Close quote.
Yeah.
Fantastic. 3.3 million tweets, made it the most popular in human history.
Yeah.
And this tweet kind of reminds me of the Muhammad Ali retort to obviously the U.S. government taking away his boxing license back in the 60s. He said, no Viet Cong ever called me nigger.
This is true. I don't know how it quite relates to that, but it does go back. It suggests
exactly.
That race
it's all about
justice is a really
racial,
old story. Yeah.
Racism, prejudices, idiosyncrasies. In school, we were never born asking each other what persuasion we came from or what religion we is. We all played football together. In the 70s, when Mokhtar Dahari, Sochinan, Arumugam, you know, were household names.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've regressed since those days. Well, I think not just Malaysia, in the world.
Yeah, but we also, I think, look at the past with rose-tinted glasses, right? I mean, we had some of the worst race riots in the 50s and the 60s. We only remember May 13th, 69.
There's a school of thought which suggests
there were
many
actually
others. Engineered.
Yes,
it's a
of course.
School of thought.
Of course. And everything, in some sense, is engineered. I mean, it's not necessarily spontaneous. It doesn't make it less true, right? Because you can try to engineer something, but if it doesn't resonate with a large group of people, it's not going to happen. I mean, I can't start a riot even if I wanted to, right? If my
Well,
it's not that easy, right? So even if I had the intention to. So it says there's a question of whether societies out there are Tinder for these kinds of political sparks, right?
I mean, believe you use Tinder.
Yeah, but, and so, yeah, you know, like things that, you know, are flammable.
Yes,
and
I
so
know,
I think
I
the important thing is, on the flip side, right? So this is Obama not inciting hatred, but in fact doing
inciting
quite
inciting love.
And why is it, do you think, that something like this resonates so strongly within the world of Twitter, you know? And beyond. And I, what is the counterpoint to this? Because we also had news coming out from this, from Charlottesville, which was the resignation of CEOs from Donald Trump's you know, advisory councils. He's now since actually disbanded his advisory councils in a preemptive move. There's, and it's crossed the Atlantic as well with leaders, you know, because I think Theresa May made some remark saying somehow that this American issue is a domestic one. She wasn't going to weigh in on it. But then she's got so much criticism from that as well. And so in some ways the ante has been up for everybody to at least portray, at least from the leaders, their better selves, right? And to stand by those values, because we know that Donald Trump eventually, I mean 2 days after the fact, and then came out and made some strong statements against neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan and such, but then
after having made statements to the otherwise,
yeah, and suggesting that both sides were to blame, and then of course then he reversed his position or seemed to dial back on his position by saying that, well, there's some fine people among the group of, you know,
just social politicians can't be trusted.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting about Donald Trump is
things.
Politicians like Donald Trump wear their hearts on their sleeves, right? So you can imagine many other wily politicians, whatever their sympathies might be, might hide it much better. Donald Trump seems incapable of hiding his true feelings, prejudices, and biases.
He so just, is that a good thing?
Well, I don't know if it's a good thing, but it's his thing, and then you know where he stands, and then you can, and of course, take a position against. I'm not saying he should get a pat on the back for it, but you certainly know where he stands, because he's incapable of you know,
yeah,
dissimulating. I mean, he's incapable of pretending to be something he's not.
Well, going back to Barack Obama's tweet, I mean, he hasn't really tweeted a lot since he retired from the presidency.
Yeah. Proving that, you know, sometimes less is more.
Yeah, true. But during his tenure, I think he ran two terms as president. He was also obviously responsible for some military incursions into the Middle East. So, I mean, if he really wanted to, you know, portray love, he is a bit hypocritical, isn't it?
Why? Why would you say that?
Well, I mean, he could have dialed back defense, cut defense spending, you know, done, for example, not spend so much on the military and spend less time irking the middle, you know, the Arabs, but he didn't.
I think, you know, what is clear about the American presidency is a complex institutional arrangement. It's not just individuals. The president who gets elected might show some direction, but he's also trapped within a system. And Obama, I think, to his credit, though there are a lot of things that, you know, the drone policy and such that I, you know, that we've talked about on this radio station, you know, vilifying America for its human rights record, its terrible human rights record when it comes to drones.
During his time, Gitmo was still very much in evidence.
Yes, but, you know, he is, you know, he is, was a creature of the system, Obama, but all that being equal, he's still much better than a Donald Trump. And I think that's evidence in the way in which people have responded to his tweets. Well, after these messages, we have the Doobie Brothers and listen to the music. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was the Doobie Brothers and listen to the music. Myself, Sharad Kutin, and himself, Kusu Chuang.
I am, he is, we are.
it's coming up to 7 o'clock, but before that, it's time to talk about some interesting information, factoids, changes in our demographics. Minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Dato Sri Abdul Rahman Dahlan, says Malaysians are living longer. And this is based on information coming from the Department of Statistics. A life expectancy of Malaysians has increased to 79 years, up from 75 years in in just the span of a 1 year. So that's quite a big jump, 4 years. Now, the minister observed that women, Malaysian women, tend to live longer. They're living 5 years longer than men. Also noted that data revealed that some 15.3% of the population would have aged when Malaysia becomes an aging nation by 2030. Now, we spoke to Professor Dr. Noran Nakia from the Prevention of Elder Abuse and Neglect Initiative, or PEACE as it calls it, on what this information, new data on life expectancy really means for us.
Yeah, I think one of the things about having all this information is, again, what do we do with it, right? So we do hope that policy keep up with demography, because we do know that there are challenges. Of course, there are advantages of living longer, right? But longevity is always associated with treasure. But then again, having said that, for you to enjoy all these things, you must make sure that you are healthy. For example, the data that we have with regard to government hospitals with geriatric wards or geriatric units up to 2016 is only 10. And in terms of doctors or family medicine specialists trained in community geriatrics, there's only about 4 geriatricians in the whole country. There's only 33 of them. So we need more trained staff, and I think the numbers need to come up fast. There is a diversity in old age, so it's not like everyone is going to be old and everyone is going to be unhealthy. There have been reports saying that you can be 90, you can be 80, but yet you're still fit to run a marathon. I mean, we've seen reports or news on those kind of things. So the idea is to ensure that the public knows that old age doesn't mean that you have to be frail. So longevity does not necessarily mean unhealthy. That's one of the things, right? So quality of life is very important. And I think that's something that we need to try and maximize our functional ability to make sure that when we are there, we are still healthy. So healthy aging, that's very, very relevant to everyone.
That was Professor Dr. Noran Nakia from the Prevention of Elder Abuse and Neglect Initiative, or PEACE. Speaking about new information that we have from the Department of Statistics about the increasing lifespans of Malaysian men and women, how to keep yourself fit, how do you, not just mentally, but also physically, I think is the key, isn't it? And I have at least members of my family who are in the 80s who are still, you know, really, they're still working, some of them. They're professionals. Some of them, you know, keep themselves really alive, you know, intellectually by having pursuits and being productive and that. And I think that's a wonderful model. We should have more models of productive older people, just because I think the traditional image is one of decline and dialing down and everything.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact that we've added 4 years to life expectancy within the space of 12 months is quite astounding. But the good professor makes a good point, because if you grow old and you're not healthy, or you're not financially capable of looking after yourself, maybe it's not such a utopia after all. But
yeah, I mean, I think this old age poverty is a huge issue.
It is
issue.
A huge issue.
Right.
And I mean, we're going to talk about news in the newspapers this morning about how Malaysian medical inflation is outstripping our regional peers. The cost of healthcare in this country is increasing faster than Indonesia or Philippines or Thailand or Singapore or other Southeast Asian countries. You know, it will come to a point, if not already, when in order to grow old, healthy and happy, you have to have some money, because otherwise it's going to be trouble.
Absolutely. We're coming up to the top of the hour then, because after the news, we'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. We have, a song now, We're a Winner by Curtis Mayfield. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Akusu Chuang. It's coming up to 6 minutes past seven. It is the 17th of August. Big news the last couple of days coming on the heels of, you know, actually several months of a real strong anti-corruption drive. And because we had news of former Felda chairman Tan Sri Issa Samad, not only his arrest, but the remand order that was given. He was given 5 days, which is, of course, the period in which the police can hold him in order to conduct investigations. I believe at this point, his home has been raided, or two of his homes have been raided for more evidence of perhaps corrupt practices. Now, we spoke to Cynthia Gabriel, founding director of C4, the Center for to Combat Corruption and Cronyism, and on her views of these recent developments.
Well, I think first, the arrest was also quite an amazing development. And now the remand must now uncover the bigger picture of what has actually gone so terribly wrong with the institution called FALDA. Who are the other persons involved? How we connect the dots to the massive corruption that has taken place over the years. So it wasn't just corruption that happened yesterday or 2 days ago. It was something that has been systemic, that has been over time, and so on. And this is a very good example of why we're very concerned about how government-linked companies are actually run, because government-linked companies actually hold massive amount of public funds, and there's very, very little scrutiny over how these government-linked companies actually carry out and implement their programs. So this is one very good example for all other JLCs to know that the governance, the way directors are appointed, who gets appointed as directors, and so on, is of extreme importance to the public, and especially to the people who are directly connected, in this case, it's the FALDA settlers. So he must immediately be suspended from all his positions, etc., etc. And the entire FALDA as an entity, as an organization, must be audited and must be revamped at its root, because the corruption problems are not going to go away by just reappointing a new chairman to make sure that it's business as usual. It cannot be business as usual.
And that was Cynthia Gabriel, founding director of C4, the Center to Combat Corruption and Cronyism. Very interesting point of view, especially from, coming from somebody whose work, because you know Cynthia Gabriel's not only in C4, she's been a long-time human rights advocate, who didn't actually display much cynicism, though I do believe there's a lot of cynicism out there, and understandably, and the bar for the government, Chuang, I think, is very high in terms of proving it's, you know, that there's genuine political will to combat corruption in this country, just because of the trust deficit, right? The trust deficit has created this rather high bar for the government. So even when they do, even when the MECC acts against somebody like Issa Samad, who's, you know, been a major figure in Barisan politics for so many decades, people are still very cynical.
Well, there's a lot of interpretations about this, but, you know, obviously this is not going to be the first time that the good former chief minister has been, I guess, analysed or investigated for activities. But, you know, just to look at it and to throw it forward, especially in our 60th year as a nation, this is the right direction, because there was a time not that long ago where we talked about how there was only sardines and, you know, ikan bilis being caught. But, you know, now we've got kind of like a whale, or like a large fish.
Absolutely, the sharks. So, you could go for a shark metaphor.
Absolutely.
But I like the whale too.
Yeah, the whale.
Though the man is quite diminutive.
Yeah.
I must say that...
And hopefully there'll be more whales, or the whales get larger.
And they might even be...
It's not a baby whale in a way, but whale nonetheless.
Okay, we're going to have to stop this. But there might be an elephant or two in the mix as well. But coming back to, I think, Cynthia's points, I mean, she made some points about systemic corruption, right? So she's saying that...
Those are strong words, delivered in a nice way.
Yeah, and so the question is, it's an ecosystem. Corruption is an ecosystem. It cannot just be one man. He might have been at the apex of it or near the apex of it, but he would have been presided over a network that made these corrupt practices possible. Also, I think the other point that Cynthia makes, which I think is very important, is that this is not something that just happened yesterday or whatever. So that the particular case that is going to be investigated, this case, the purchase of certain luxury hotels, shouldn't blindside us from the fact that it's the ecosystem that needs to be investigated.
We need
to know how deep the rot is in FALDA.
This is a good opportunity to overhaul the structure, because there's many other smaller institutions like FALDA which don't have the same levels of accountability. I mean, when you look at FALDA itself, they have two or three large subsidiary entities, FGV being one of them, FALDA Investment Corporation being another one, and KPF being another one. But FALDA itself is by and large invisible to the public eye, even though they hold the crown jewels to Malaysia's plantation and sugar assets. And, you know, at this point in time, I think since 2004, it's only been under the purview of the Prime Minister's office and no one else. So unless there is an insight into the accountability and the governance and the oversight procedures within the institution, it is still an invisible entity. And this is an opportunity to really restructure the whole thing. And the current chairman...
Shahid Samad.
Yeah, correct. As well as at FGV level as well. They come from governance background, so hopefully things will change.
Well, you know, I think there's, we often also look at the question of political will. We look at leadership in this question of the drive against corruption. But I think there is also the question of public pressure. I think Malaysians generally, increasingly, though there's still a good number of Malaysians who don't care about corruption, but there are a lot of Malaysians who do. It's the stuff of political, you know, legitimacy or in fact, it counts as a way of diminishing your political legitimacy. And so, you know, there's pressure on politicians today to deliver, at least on one level, just the message. I mean, they at least have to be seen to be speaking against corruption. But once they do that, they up the ante on themselves.
Well, it's
right?
necessary, isn't it? And what is it? Bloomberg makes a big deal out of all the time about how the Felder constituency is roughly, what, a quarter or, you know, nearly a quarter
well,
of
there are
all
many, there
222
many,
in the country?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, one of the NGOs that is related to Felder is ANA, and that's because of all the children and the pioneers of the Felder schemes who have lauded this move. They've welcomed this move. And to appease them, perhaps, the government is also under pressure to act, right? So, and this is true of all democratic governments everywhere in the world. You know, the popular pressure will shape the way they speak about the world, will shape their policies and actions. So I think we see some of that happening. There's a broad enough sort of Malaysians who care about what corruption has done to this country. But I think, I guess, at some point, what we hope this investigation reveals also is the tie-up between corruption and political patronage, right? To the extent that political leaders engage in corrupt practices in order to develop a war chest that lubricates their political machinery. I mean, so, you know, how do you, if your system is built on handouts and you know, giving gifts and contracts, how can you do that if you don't, in fact, abuse the very institutions that you're charged with running, right?
What's that show that Kevin Spacey's in? House of Cards?
Yes,
like that,
that's
really.
Right. House
like that, really.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, the expression pork barrel politics and all this isn't Malaysian. This is a problem around the world, right? And so I think what we can dial down on is a lot of self-loathing that happens in Malaysia, even especially among the chattering classes, about our problems, because our problems are not unique. And the thing is to look at some successful cases and scenarios around the world. We look at corruption and say the police force in Hong Kong has been very successful in rooting out.
Right, in the 70s. Yeah. And I think for those among us who have longer memories than others, there was a time when, you know, two or three prime ministers ago, when such discussions never took place because the walls, as it was said at the time, had ears, right? And, you know, even public discussions on public radio of this nature never took place.
Yeah.
So things have changed. And sometimes I get a bit cynical, and Shaw, you always put me right on this issue, quite rightly so. Things have changed. Things have improved.
Yeah. We're coming up to a short break, and then we'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.